Hi, you're listening to A Rugby Life. I'm your host, Teddy Legrand, and today I am joined by Roberto Santiago, or better known as Berto to his friends. He's a good mate of mine, and he is currently out in California as a referee with the Northern California Referee Society, and occasionally plays. Hi, Berto, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
Good. Well, welcome to the show. Get kick-started off here, right? So, I mean, I've known you for quite a few years, and of course I know your story, but our listeners don't know where your original origins are. So how did your rugby career start out?
Well, I grew up in Berkeley, California, and Northern California actually has quite a bit of rugby. I don't know what the count was way back when I was in high school, but now I believe that the Northern California area has, 60 U19 teams or somewhere thereabouts. So I had actually never been exposed to rugby. I had a friend who had moved here from England, and he saw a flyer up in the hallways at school, our freshman year of high school. And he wanted to go out for the team, but he didn't want to go by himself. So he convinced me to go. And I've stuck with it ever since. So from 14 to 32, however long that is, 18 years or so.
Okay, so you've had a pretty extensive rugby career. What were you playing when you first started out?
Funny enough, you know, of course, this being America and rugby being a sport that doesn't draw a ton of participants, I played, starting in high school, I was a flanker, was actually one of my first positions, even though at the time I was probably about 5'10 and weighed 115 pounds or so. But I mostly played out on the wing and spent some time at flanker.
When you went to college, did you start playing there as well?
As it turned out, my college didn't have a team, and I had a hard time finding one in college. So I played, after my U19 career was done, I played a bit for the Diablo Gales, which is now a Division II team here. They're a Division III team at the time. I played with them through a few of my university years and then had to focus on school and was actually away from the game for a few years until I moved to Washington, D.C.
Okay. Both of us ended up playing for the same club, but you ended up joining a little bit earlier for yours. So how did you discover the Washington Renegades?
Well, it was kind of a funny thing. I was at a Kinko's waiting to make some copies, and there was a guy there using the copier that I needed to use. And so I'm waiting, and he's wearing some rugby-branded clothing. And so I kind of struck up a conversation because I figured if I'm waiting, I may as well talk to people. And it turns out he was from Berkeley. He had gone to one of the rival high schools. And, of course, with my U19 team in high school was sort of an area team. So I had, you know, played with people who had gone to his school, although far after he did. So we started talking about being from Berkeley and talking about rugby. And it turned out the thing that he was printing were recruitment flyers. So he gave me one. And I came out to the next recruitment event and started playing with the club at that point.
Okay, when was that?
That was 2004.
2004. Okay, yeah, because I didn't come on board, I think, myself until, I think it was like 2005, I believe?
I think it was about 2005.
So one of the things that I probably, like, a lot of people didn't know, because it's interesting with the Renegades team, of course, the Integrate is a kind of mixed, they call it a multicultural team, and so, like, a lot of the players come from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different sort of social backgrounds, but also there's one of the few teams out there that is a gay-friendly team. How did that, I mean, when did you first find that out? I mean, was that something you struck up in conversation, or did you find that out once you went out to practice?
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Having grown up in Berkeley and being in the San Francisco area, I think, put me at a bit of a, I wouldn't say a disadvantage, but it put me in the interesting position of not noticing the makeup of the team for several weeks. I went to one of the early practices, and it was still winter. There was still snow on the ground, so it was an indoors practice. And I noticed there was one guy, and he had a tattoo on his calf of the two male symbols intertwined, you know. I thought, man, you know, here this is, you know, a rugby team. This guy is clearly openly gay, and nobody seems to care. Like, that is so cool. Like, how cool is that? These must be really good guys. And then, like, you know, the next week or the week, you know, a couple weeks later, I noticed there's a couple guys, you know, holding hands and being, you know, very intimate with each other. And thinking, wow, you know, there's a couple of really openly gay guys on the team. These guys must be so cool to just be so accepting and welcoming of that. Like, I really found a great group of guys. And it really took me probably 6 weeks or so before I understood that it had been founded as a club that had primarily recruited homosexual men as players. I wouldn't say it wasn't a shock. It was just kind of like, how stupid could I be? that I just simply hadn't noticed. But I do think that it speaks to the quality of the rugby and the focus of the team. Because I think a lot of people hear gay rugby team and they think it's like an adult film or something, and they expect everyone to be prancing around and kissing each other in the rucks or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that's one of the things that shows both sort of the welcoming environment for everyone for that particular team, and as well as the fact that it really is a rugby team that's focused on rugby.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. And I mean, I think they're so well organized as well, which was something that was so refreshing to be with a club that were that well organized. And, you know, certainly from hearing the season results from this year, I mean, they are gone from strength to strength as a team.
Oh, yeah. I remember my first season with the club, we would lose games, you know, 10-7 or 15-3, and everyone was thrilled. And I'd say, well, what are you so happy about? You know, we just lost. You know, everyone's happy. It goes, oh, well, last year we lost to these guys 116-12, you know. So, you know, they were coming from a perspective of being beaten by 100 points every week to only being beaten by 10, you know, and I was upset about losing. And it sort of progressed from there to them, you know, having the 7-1 season and you know, really by all rights should have been in the playoffs.
So from your time with the Renegades, what are the big events that stick out of your mind?
My very first season with the club, I was picked to be sponsored by the club to go over and play A-side in the Bingham Cup in London, and that was an experience of a lifetime. You know, for someone such as myself who, you know, I mean the best I ever got skill-wise was to be a very solid Division III player, you know, and to play at sort of a lower level of rugby, but still have that experience of being able to go on an international tour and, you know, not have to pay through the nose for it because the club felt you were good enough to throw some sponsorship money down.
Yeah.
And to have that, you know, to play teams from other countries and to just sort of be in that whole environment was amazing. I mean, that was probably one of the most exciting things I've done in rugby.
Yep.
to this point.
And you've taken part in 3 of the Bingham Cups now. And actually, one of the clubs, and actually, I gather you played, you may remember it, you actually played in one of the Bingham Cups under my lovely coachy tutelage.
I did. The 2006 Cup in New York, I very foolishly separated my shoulder 6 weeks prior to that tournament. But was determined to play, and when I went and got my x-ray done, the morning the bus left to go from D.C. to New York, my doctor said, of course, under no circumstances should you play rugby this weekend. Okay, but, you know, theoretically, if you had a guy who was going to play, how would you tape his shoulder? Hypothetically, if you could show me that, that would be great, just out of curiosity. And I jumped on the bus and went up, and I did end up sitting out the first day, and then ended up playing the last, what was it, 4 games or so at fullback.
Yeah. Well, I figured out that was the safest place to put you.
yeah. And I had, in each game, I had 1 run, 1 tackle, and 1 ruck. And the rest was just kick and catch, or catch and kick, maybe.
And for the listeners that were interested, both teams, there was both an A and a B side, and I was very honored to be able to lead the B side up there. And, both teams finished 3rd overall, which I think was an outstanding effort.
Yeah, it was good. And I believe both teams lost to the eventual champions
in their
semifinal.
Yeah, it was the Aussies, the Sydney Convicts. So you went out. So the last Bingham, I gather, was in Dublin. Now, how was that for an experience to play?
Now, that was also an amazing experience because I had to delay my flight to Dublin so that I could watch my little brother's high school graduation. So we watched The Graduation, and we jumped on the plane, and we flew, you know, from California to Dublin is like 8,000 hours or something. And so we flew the entire week over to Dublin and landed, and within 90 minutes, I was on the pitch.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we landed, we jumped off, we grabbed our bags, we got in the rental car. I completely messed up driving on the wrong side for about 20 minutes. We found the field. basically, as soon as I arrived, the B-side was warming up for their last match. And they're like, great, Birdo, you're here. You're in. And so I pretty much ran straight from the tarmac onto the field and played there, and then played a game as a sub for the San Francisco Fog, whose B-side was very, very short due to injury.
Yeah.
So I got two matches in, and it was that was also a great experience because I knew that I had married a good woman when, after I proposed, she said, and we can have our honeymoon at the Bingham Cup. Yeah, so, you know, that's what you're looking for in a lifetime commitment.
So how did you go from, because, I mean, now these days, you I know you play a little bit every so often, but I know also that you're refereeing. Now, how did you go about becoming a referee?
Well, as I mentioned, in 2006, I had the shoulder injury. And professionally, I'm a sign language interpreter, which means that my shoulders are quite precious to me. Without those, I have no livelihood. And so basically, after playing for, I believe it was, 14 or 15 or 16 years at that point, without ever having had a major injury until then, I decided, you know, I'm not going to push it all. I'll go ahead and call it a career with the shoulder injury. But I knew I wanted to continue to be involved with the game. And I got an email that I think they actually just wrote specifically for me from the Potomac referees. And it said, you know, we're having a referee class. And as many of you players know, a lot of our referees are a bit older, perhaps a bit out of shape. And so the guy we're looking for, I mean, we'll take that, 38-year-old guy who realizes he can't play anymore. But the guy we really want is the guy with good wheels and a bad wing, you know, and that was me. You know, I still had my legs, I still had my speed, I still had my fitness. I couldn't play because of the shoulder. And it was like the email was speaking directly to me, saying, Birdo, come be a referee. So I went for it, and I took the class, and took my first couple of referee assignments, and I've loved it. It's been fantastic. So that sort of got the ball rolling. From a referee's perspective.
So obviously when you moved to California and you moved out, because when you moved from Washington out to back to San Francisco.
Yep.
And so when did you join the Pelicans?
Almost immediately. We moved here, I believe we got here the first or second week of October or so. And a week later, I got the email from the Pelicans saying every new referee has to come down to the Stanford Tens tournament. And referee, so we can get a look at you. And that's it. So basically, it was instantly. I had sent an email to them letting them know that I was coming out, and Skip Vaughn from Potomac, who had, I believe, previously been a Pelican, sent them an email sort of giving them his impression of me and my credentials. And so I got a nice little introduction and was welcomed with open arms.
How long have you been refereeing now?
Well, I guess it's been since 2007, if you call it that. So it's been about 2.5 years.
And so I know there are different referee levels based off, you know, your evaluations and performances. Where are you at? Where are you pitched at the moment? What's your level?
I'm currently a C2, which is basically, I mean, you pass the test and they call you a D. And then you get a couple of games. And you go to C3, and then C2, C1, and then there's a big sort of gap between C1 and B3. So I'm a C2 currently. I'm hoping to be a C1 this year, or by the end of 2010, whatever, you know, sort of this season, since in California, the season hasn't started yet. So I'm hoping over the course of this season I can get a couple of evaluations and move up to C1 and be ready for Bingham in the summer.
You mentioned Bingham's because I gather you're actually going to be going out to referee at the tournament.
Yeah, well, my original plan was to go out and hook up with the B-side for the Renegades. But, again, you know, keeping my shoulder in mind and my mortgage and my son and my family and everything, I decided, you know, perhaps it would be more prudent for me to referee. And so I'm in the process of trying to work out an exchange with the Minnesota Referees Society, which the Pelicans seem to think is a great idea. And so hopefully I'll be out there refereeing in some capacity. That would also be fantastic, another sort of transition in this grand rugby life from being a player and a participant to being a referee and a facilitator.
So what do you find, I mean, as a referee, what are like the good things, what do you find are the difficult things being as a ref?
The good things are definitely the fact that you get to see some really good games from a very good vantage point. I was fortunate enough to do a B-side for Cal against, I want to say, Texas A&M, which did not end up being a competitive match from a scoreboard standpoint, but from a referee's perspective, being able to be at the field level, obviously, and up close to the players and up close to the action and seeing how it is that Cal does what they do to be successful, you know, how their success actually works from a very, you know, a very intimate perspective is, that's one of the really fun things for me, you know, and also just, you know, knowing that, you know, this game has given so much, I think, to all of us, you know, I mean, what's your typical experience? You pay $100 in dues or whatever to your club, and then you get, you know, free food and drinks every weekend for like the whole year. That's not bad, yeah. You know? And if you do that for enough years, you realize that, you know, you've gotten a lot. And I got the trip to London and, you know, that the trip on the bus up to New York was one of those classic, you know, things that I'll never forget. You know, Dublin, I've gotten so much out of being a rugby player that there's a tremendous amount of satisfaction in knowing that you're able to give up your time and volunteer to go out and facilitate other people having a good time playing rugby.
Yep.
So that's probably the most positive thing. I would say the negatives are being screamed at. You get screamed at a lot, especially when you're first starting out, or from people who maybe don't exhibit the sportsmanship that we like to have. Which is really a shame because it happens a lot at the U19 level. You have a lot of people involved in coaching under-19s who probably shouldn't be around kids just because they're not good role models.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a coach that's yelling at the ref, you're going to have players who feel like they can yell at the ref. And, of course, you know, one of the things that we're all striving for in the rugby community is, you know, respect. Respect for your opponent, respect for the ref, respect for the coaches, respect for the game in general. And that's one of the hardest things when you see people who, I mean, if they're abusing the ref, the chances are that they're not respecting the game and they're not turning out the types of rugby players at the U19 level that we want to see at the college level or the Super League level or the international level.
Yeah, I mean, I know from my experience, as you know, so I was a referee for a year with the Potomac Referee Society as well, and it was an eye-opening experience. And I think we shared this sentiment before, is that you definitely experience it's a different world when you're on the other side, when you're not on that pitch playing, and you're now standing there. And I certainly noticed that. Yeah, same thing. It's like people are very quick to criticize the ref.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel that, you know, I certainly totally agree with you on that one. But how do you find for yourself? Do you find that you're a better referee because you've been a player, or you find that you're a better player now that you've been a referee?
Certainly a better player now that I've been a referee. I know what the ref can and can't see. I know what the ref can and can't control, which is a big thing. As you well know, I was quite temperamental as a player.
That's mildly put. Well put, by the way.
And part of that was, you know, when you're out on the wing, you can see everything. And you can see things that the ref doesn't necessarily see. And it can be very frustrating. Having been a ref now, I understand more when I play, you know, what the ref's trying to do, what they're letting go. Because sometimes players, they want you to call every technical infraction. And one of the big things as a referee, and something that I would love players to understand, is this idea of materiality. Perhaps there was an infraction, but did it matter? Right? So suppose you have a ruck. The ball is clearly one to white, right? Clearly. Like, the other team is not going to push this ruck over. They're not going to dig it out. It is one by white. And after that, in order to help the ball get out, there's a little hand in, you know? Or from the bottom of the pile, there's a little hand pushing the ball back out towards the back so the scrum half can get it. That's actually helping the game, you know? So you see a player who sees that and they want hands in. Well, the ruck, there was no contest for the ball at that point. What we really want is for the ball to come out and everyone can play, and then you can contest for the ball at the next breakdown, you know? Or a player who is a step off sides, but on the blind side and the play is going to the wide side. We're not going to, you know, I don't want to blow that up right there because it's immaterial. And those are sort of some very, I don't know, wishy-washy examples, but the point is that from a referee's perspective, you don't always want to call every single technical issue because you're trying to have some flow for the game. And you're trying to do that in a manner that is going to be fair and in a manner that isn't going to frustrate people. But at the same time, you know, if you read the beginning of the law book, before you actually get to the laws, the whole idea is a flowing contest. You don't want to stop and have a scrum every 10 seconds. Yeah, that's not fun for the players. It's not fun for the crowd. It's not fun for the ref. You know.
Yeah, it's about striking a balance of continuity. And I think that I definitely know from my experience, it is difficult. It is difficult. And I think you still see it at coaches. And it frustrates me no end to see that with coaches that basically ball out a referee. And we know referees are at different levels. And maybe you can talk to that a bit about the evaluation process, about what really goes into the evaluation process of a referee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I would say one thing about that sort of as the preface, which is, we all need to understand who we are in the moment, right? So, you know, when I was a D-level referee, I knew that I didn't know very much at all and that things were going to be rough. As a C3, you know, I knew more. As a C2, I know more. I have a good idea of who I am and what the weaknesses are in my game. What's very important is for everyone involved to know who they are. So if you're a D3 team and it's the end of the year and you have no wins and you're playing another D3 team with no wins, you're not going to get an A-panel referee. The A-panel referees are doing the Super League games, or they're, you know, they're getting ready to become international referees. And the B-panel referees are doing, you know, the Division I games and the college playoffs. And you are going to get the new guy. You're going to get the C3 guy who was just a player last season and is learning what he's doing. And because you're a D3 team, you need to understand that you're not very good in the grand scale of things, and neither is the ref. And you're all on that level together. And as you move up as a player, you can expect a higher quality of referee. Which means, of course, you know, you don't just give every referee a pass if they're completely, you know, horrible. But there does need to be some understanding for playing to what the ref is going to call. And so if you feel like there's something that is consistently not being called, that's the law interpretation for that day, and you need to roll with it. And you need to understand the level of competition that you're at is also going to dictate the level of referees that you get.
So, I mean, for something like that, I mean, I know that's something that it faces a lot of different referee societies. Are the Pelicans pretty good at, like, being able to, like, recruit new referees in and be able to sort of, you know, maintain and encourage and grow, basically?
Yeah, actually, the Pelicans, and I'll try to say this with some modesty, the Pelicans are probably the best referee society in the United States. They do a very good job bringing in new referees. They do a very good job providing the tools for those referees to get better. And they do an excellent job putting people in national level or sometimes even international appointments. Quite a few of the refs from Northern California go on to hold positions either with USA Rugby or with the national referee panel, mm-hmm. Or the national administration of referees. It's a fantastic society. And, you know, of course, I don't want to say negative things about any of the other societies, but I think a lot of them, because they're suffering for resources, I think all societies are suffering for resources, there just simply aren't enough refs. It's hard sometimes to get the support as a new referee that you need in order to develop. And I found that here, the very first game I did in Northern California I was mic'd, I had a video camera, and I got a DVD with my comments and the coach's comments and the game on there.
That's outstanding.
Yeah, yeah. And so the level of support that we get out here is really fantastic. I've been on two exchanges, which have been a lot of fun. And I went to the Saranac tournament, the Can-Am, up in New York, and actually got a evaluation and coaching from a national panel referee coach, which is something that, I mean, that was a thrill.
So what do you see for your referee future? Where would you like to see yourself?
Well, I think it was evident early on that I had much more potential as a referee than I'd ever had as a player. And from that standpoint, it's probably a good thing that I was injured in my early 30s, because otherwise I'd probably still be out mucking it up trying to play my own particular brand of rugby. I think I would be very happy and satisfied if I could get to be a B-panel referee.
Yep.
And get some of those sort of maybe lower-level national assignments or whatever. Of course, I would be ecstatic. I mean, I think it would go beyond my dreams if I were to become an A-level. I don't know if perhaps I got into it at too advanced an age to ever make it that far. But I think a B-panel ref is a pretty realistic goal for who I am and my age and, you know, what you project in terms of fitness and the ability to keep up with better players as time goes on. But hey, you know, who knows, maybe I'll get a chance to run up and down with a flag at a at the Olympics someday. Who knows?
Well, that definitely, I wish you good luck with that. And I said that, you know, that's, you know, having some other discussions that I've had with teams and stuff in the Sevens, it'll be very interesting to see how that all pans out. One thing I was going to do before I wrap it up with you today is, like, so I talk about your real job that you do every day.
Yeah, I'm a sign language interpreter. And so what I do is, you know, I facilitate communication between people who are deaf or hard of hearing and use sign language, and people who are of their regular hearing abilities and who use English to communicate. And that, much like rugby, has taken me some pretty interesting places. And I think one of the most interesting things I've been able to do as an interpreter, I interpreted the national Christmas tree lighting a couple of years ago. And so I was sitting approximately 6 feet from President Bush, although 6 feet and, you know, 8 inches of bulletproof glass separated us. But there we were. I interpreted his speech, which was pretty exciting, and was mistaken on 3 occasions for a Secret Service member because we were all wearing the same coats.
Excellent. But there was one thing I was going to bring up. You just reminded me of a great story, and I remember seeing this firsthand myself with the Renegades, was that you actually helped with, we actually had deaf players on the team.
Yes, we did. We had, I was a graduate student at Gallaudet University, which is a university that is primarily for deaf people. It's the only, it's the only deaf liberal arts university in the world. And of course, there's some hearing people there, mostly in the graduate school. So I was a student there when I was playing with the Renegades, and I recruited 3 people that I knew from school to come out and play, and they actually ended up playing a couple of seasons for us.
Because I always love playing. Like I said, it's fascinating to have that, because you think to yourself, like, a player's deaf, how the heck are they going to play? I think the most amazing thing watching, which I thought was tactically one of the best things I've ever seen, was the silent lineouts.
Oh, yeah, the silent lineouts were brilliant. I don't know why everyone doesn't do that, you know, now that they're no longer playing. I think, you know, it's safe to give away, but I mean, it's something as simple as when the thrower has their right foot as the front foot, it's the first jumper, and when they have their left foot, it's the second jumper. And then whatever you scream and yell is just nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, and all you have to do as a member of the lineout is just check the foot when you come up to the line, and you're all set. You know, that kind of thing. We had hand signals for all of our plays. Basically, everyone learned the alphabet, and everyone knew the first letter of the play. And so the fly half would just cross his hands behind his back and give a letter. And the back line knew the play. I mean, it's really, and if you think about back line spacing a lot of the time, especially if you're fortunate enough to play on a full pitch, you don't want to be screaming things out. I think that silent signals are something that any team can use to their advantage. But it was fantastic having those dev players. I think it was a great experience for the team to see how that can work, and what was great is that the coaching staff was so receptive to it. You know, they never balked. They never said, well, wait, how's this going to work?
Yep.
It was more like, oh, hey, how's this going to work? Like, they were really excited to integrate these deaf players into the team, and I know that the three of them had a blast. They loved their time with the team. Really, really. Just, again, it's that team. That is a great group of guys. They're very welcoming. They're very inclusive. And I think just about anyone who has an interest in playing rugby, if you're in D.C., look up the Renegades. If you want a home for your rugby life, it's not a bad place to be.
Yeah, and I'll second you on that. I'll definitely second you on that. But well, Roberto, thank you very much for your time today. I wish you all the best. I'll keep my eyes and ears peeled for your future referee assignments and stuff.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Good, folks. Well, thank you again for listening to Another Rugby Life. Thanks a lot.